Good morning, and what a week it was.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how simple it's going to be, though. It'll be stupid simple, because that's where I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep asking the tech questions. When is the cheque arriving?
Well, Jesus, you know, you definitely need the donkey in the room.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it works so far, because if we stay in their language, nothing happens.
Yeah.
Get into the fuck. Simple speaking, we need the moolah, you have it, so you're going to give it to us, and when would that be? We'll start there.
Yeah.
And by the way, the game has changed, because really the problem is now on their door.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, because if they don't give us on Monday, they have a bank collapse. Potentially, if the fucking money keeps running out the door the way it has been running out the door.
That's it.
So we'll be sitting there kind of going, we'll be kind of a little bit somber looking, sort of, look, you know, what do you want? How are you getting on that loan, lad?
Yeah.
Don't you want some fucking keys now? I can give them to you. So I'm relaxed about it, John.
Okay.
But anyway, we'll see about that tomorrow. Half 10 in here for a pep talk, and then off we go. We'll go down in one car and go into the car park. That way we won't get seen going in.
I'd say, well, look, I would say 10. I would say 10. And if we get a cup of coffee around the corner, we get a cup of coffee.
10 o'clock it is.
Yeah.
You the man.
Okay.
All righty.
See you, bye.
See you, bye, bye, bye.
How many times over the past 5 years have you wondered what really went on in government buildings on that frenzied night of the bank guarantee in September 2008? And what led Brian Lenihan, Fianna Fáil and the Greens to that fateful decision? On Monday morning, our worst fears were confirmed when the Irish Independent published explosive recordings of phone conversations between two senior executives of Anglo-Irish Bank just days before the government gave a blanket guarantee to the banks. The story, by Paul Williams, revealed a strategy to lure the state into shoring up Anglo, a plan which ended up costing the taxpayer €30 billion and virtually bankrupted the country. In this recording, you'll hear John Bowe, then head of capital markets, and Peter Fitzgerald, the bank's then director of retail banking, as they discuss an upcoming meeting with the financial regulator at the time, Patrick Neary, and how they would be seeking €7 billion in bridging finance from the central bank. And it's worth saying that the two men deny allegations that they participated in misleading the central bank.
There's a lot at stake here, isn't there?
Yeah.
How do they make it happen?
That's if we make it happen.
How do they make it happen, you know?
Yeah. But we're into a different phase now, you know?
Oh, we are, yeah. And how did you arrive at the seven?
What we did was we basically said, what is the amount that we can securitize over the next 6 months?
Yeah.
And basically say to them, look, our problem is time. It's not our ability to create the liquidity. It's the enemy is time here.
Yeah.
So we can rebuild, in other words, we can rebuild the liquidity off our loan book. But what we can't do is we can't do it now, and the balance sheet is leaking now.
Yeah. And that's the balance sheet stabilizes.
And that number is 7, but the reality is that actually we need more than that. But the strategy here is you pull them in, you get them to write a big check, and they have to support their money, you know.
Yeah. They've got skin in the game. That's the key.
They have, and they've invested a lot. If they saw the enormity of it up front, they might decide they have a choice. You know what I mean? They might say that the cost to taxpayers is too high. But if it doesn't look too big at the outset, it looks big enough to be important, but not too big that it kind of spoils everything, then I think you have a chance. So I think it can creep up.
Yeah. They'll give you a bit of truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think will happen?
What do I think will happen? I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know. I mean, I don't think we're an easy sell.
No.
To anybody. And the home interest should be there, except they don't have the financial standing themselves. So do I think it's going to be possible to offload it? No, I don't.
Yeah.
What will it end up being? It could be breaking it up and selling individual books. It could be nationalisation. Yeah. You know?
And what's really chilling is hearing the voices and the contemptuous and mocking tone of the two senior executives. The journalist who broke the story, Paul Williams, gave the background to Áine Lawler on Morning Ireland.
Just again, Paul, to clarify for people who were listening to that, these are two senior people in Anglo-Irish Bank. Mm. They're talking about the approach to the central bank that yes. Anglo was making for emergency liquidity funding. Mm-hmm. They're saying, in reality, yes, we're going to need more than the 7 billion yeah. we're asking for. The strategy is to pull them in, so the central bank writes a big check,
yeah.
and then they'll have to back up that money.
They have to mind the money. They have a lot of money in the game. And they, as Peter Fitzgerald said, they use these footballing parlance, or sporting parlance, we've skin in the game. The government have,
and they might
history.
Decide they have a choice if they saw the scale of what they were being exposed to here.
And the strategy worked. The bank was nationalised and bailed out to the tune of 30 billion euro. These conversations took place on the 18th of September 2008, 3 days after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, when all lines of credit would have dried up.
Anybody who has seen these transcripts would say this is extraordinary, but also it illustrates the absolute need for a properly constituted public inquiry into what happened in our banks, because every man, woman and child in Ireland is paying for all of this stuff since.
On Tuesday, there were further revelations. This time, we were treated to Anglo the musical with laddish sniggering and a rendition of the Nazi version of the German national anthem. And this time, the recordings were of conversations between John Bowe, then Director of Capital Markets at Anglo-Irish Bank, and David Drum, Anglo's chief executive, in the wake of the bank guarantee. And there's relief at the top in the bank that the government has come to the rescue.
JB.
Hi.
How are you?
Grant.
Good.
Grant. David there?
Yep.
John. Hiya.
How's it going?
Grant.
What's up today?
Making nice progress.
You're abusing that guarantee. You're paying too much in Germany, I heard now as well. It's fucking ridiculous, John.
Deutschland, Deutschland, überall.
Donal O'Donovan of the Irish Independent gave Áine Lawler the context.
When David Drum says to John Bowe, oh, you're abusing that guarantee, what's going on there?
Yeah, it's a real jokey reference, but of course it's deadly serious. The guarantee was introduced so that the banks here could hold on to the deposits to prevent a flight of deposits out of the Irish bank. It was controversial because there were fears across the rest of Europe, real fears. Anglomerc called it unacceptable that it would lead to a flight of deposits into Ireland from out of European banks and into Irish banks. And so the banks here were told that this was to protect them. It wasn't to bolster. It wasn't to damage other banks.
And they weren't supposed to abuse the guarantee.
And they weren't supposed to abuse the guarantee. They weren't supposed to go looking for deposits abroad. They weren't supposed to encourage in money from German banks or from UK banks. We hear them mocking the German sort of fears around this. And we later hear about them sticking two fingers up to the UK concerns.
And in this second extract, it's clear that Anglo executives were prepared to sacrifice Ireland's relations with the UK and Germany if it meant Anglo Bank could be propped up by attracting sought-after customer deposits away from rivals.
And let's hear the second extract now. And here again, David Drum and John Bowe are talking about how to keep taking in those deposits, because there was this desperate concern, it seems, emerging from this tape to get the money in, no matter what the rest of Europe thought.
The bank had lost a huge amount of money in deposits over the previous weeks, and it had this great wheeze to replace that money.
So I'm just saying to the guys, look, just be smart.
Yeah.
Don't be stupid. Get it in. Don't be overtly pumping it so that somebody can quote you.
Yeah.
But we want to get the liquidity ratios up.
Correct.
You know?
Correct and right.
So,
okay, so just keep nursing along.
We will. Now, I have... Sorry, go on.
Back the ratio. That's what I really meant. Get the fucking money in. Get it in.
That's right, just do it.
Not surprisingly, the Germans weren't laughing at this mocking attitude towards German depositors, and it didn't go unnoticed in the German press this week. Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung ran a withering headline, a subject Áine Lawler discussed with Derek Scally of the Irish Times.
It's a pretty remarkable sentence, isn't it, Derek? Put the ex-Anglo executives in a sack with the last Irish government, the regulator, the central bank, then hit the sack with a club until the screams of pain are unbearable. We seem to have annoyed some people in Germany.
Well, it's remarkable on several levels. Number one, the Frankfurt Allgemeine would be, I suppose, an equivalent of the Irish Times in terms of it aims for seriousness. And the fact that it's losing the rag in this morning's paper gives an indication of how annoyed they are about this. And secondly, Ireland really, throughout the crisis, Ireland's actually had a fairly easy ride in comparison to the treatment of some other bailout candidates like Greece and Cyprus in the German media. We had 6 months to the end of the programme and then this happened. So Germans waking up this morning, opening their Bild tabloid newspaper. The front page headline is Irish broke bankers mock German customers. This is obviously a reference to the singing of the Deutschland, Deutschland über alles, which is the Nazi era first verse of the German national anthem, which really hasn't been sung for 60 years here. It's considered quite an insult to do that, whether intentionally or out of ignorance.
And on Thursday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the tone and content of the conversations were impossible to stomach, and she regarded them with contempt.
It's an incredible challenge for us to convince people who get up every morning to do their work, who always pay taxes, who even show solidarity with others who are weaker. It is damaging. This is why I regard this with contempt.
And there was shock and revulsion across the airwaves at this master of the universe style tone and macho behaviour. Martina Devlin, co-author of Banksters with RTE's David Murphy, explained the culture inside the bank to Mary Wilson.
I said we're not surprised, Martina, but is it surprising that what we're hearing still has the capacity to shock us 5 years on?
Yes, it is pretty shocking. I mean, what I find most amazing is that the executives on these tapes are so stereotypical, you'd nearly imagine they're sending up the cliche of the testosterone-driven alpha male. I mean, it's almost cartoon-level macho posturing. They sound like pimply 15-year-olds plotting to steal the keys to daddy's sports cars so they can go out and pull some birds. And you wouldn't take them seriously, except this is deadly serious. An entire nation is about to be sacrificed to their greed and ruthlessness. And I don't suppose they knew the level of what lay ahead for people, but they certainly knew that there was deception afoot. And meanwhile, they're puffing out their chests, they're throwing out the expletives, and they're chortling at the rinky-dinks they're pulling off. They're radiating bravado and bluster, but there's an element of panic behind it and a desire to save their skins at all costs.
As you listened through the tapes yesterday and today, what for you was maybe the single most important lesson?
I noticed the groupthink. That was the thing about this culture that occurred to me. It's a blinkered culture. Nobody challenges the consensus. Even as Armageddon looms, they continue to insist that Anglo's difficulties are down to liquidity rather than insolvency. You know, at this stage, they're hemorrhaging 1.5 billion euro a day. But it's just a little cash flow hiccup. The other thing I noticed about it is that there's no sense of gratitude that the Irish government has guaranteed them. And in another tape, you can hear David Drum say, look, just take the money, stick your fingers up at it. And they're laughing.
Writer Martina Devlin with Mary Wilson on Drive Time. And throughout the week and across all programmes, RTE's business editor David Murphy has been analysing and making sense of the complicated recordings and goings-on at Anglo.
From speaking to people who used to work in the bank at the time, we know at that time the bank was losing money so quickly. The people who worked there say it was like being on a canoe and you're heading for a waterfall. You know you're going to go over, and no matter how much you try to paddle backwards, the canoe is going to go over. And the atmosphere in the bank became very tense. And I think that to a certain extent got to some of the people, and that influences the way they were speaking, but also the way they were thinking about the regulator, that they thought that the regulator had to provide the money to rescue the bank and then that would sort out the problem. Whereas in reality, the bank was rapidly going down the tube. And there isn't, in David Drum's remarks, a sense of responsibility that perhaps this is his fault. He was running the bank. It's not the regulator who was running the bank.
And from what you're saying, David, it is the case that the position is, in terms of available evidence or recorded evidence, tapes, that what we have is what many people suspected. Tapes from the dealing room or those in a senior position in the dealing room, but not from anywhere else in the bank. For example, from David Drum's office.
That's right. So in other words, David Drum's contacts with the central bank, his contacts with the government. They weren't recorded. The phone conversations of the board, they wouldn't have been recorded. The phone conversations of the senior lenders wouldn't have been recorded. So perhaps the most senior person in the bank who had their calls recorded would have been John Bowe. And that's why all of the calls actually relate to him. Mr. Bowe's function was primarily to deal with the funds, which were by way of deposits and other liquidity that the bank took in every morning or deposited elsewhere in the afternoon. So, in fact, he's not the most senior person there, but by virtue of the fact that his calls are recorded, we're getting an insight into what was happening at management level. The bulk of the recorded calls in the bank were dealing room calls, so they would have been calls with clients who might have wanted to buy some sterling in the afternoon or something like that. So in a sense, that means that the really important calls probably weren't recorded at all.
RTE's business editor David Murphy with Cathal McCullough.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
You know, there isn't a town or village in the country that hasn't been affected by the recession and the scale of the austerity measures. Some people have taken their own lives, others have emigrated, many have lost their homes and their jobs. Edward was just one of those who rang Joe Duffy on the live line about the Anglo phone tapes.
Those guys in that bank knew. They knew exactly what was going on. But at the end of the day, like rats on a sinking ship, they had all their little apples in their baskets before that ship sank. And that's what's wrong. If the revenue wants to go after somebody, go after David Drum, go after Singleton and the rest of those and strip them from everything they have because they don't deserve it. And take that money and use it for good. But people like me out there that have a mortgage that's killing me, that can't afford property tax, it's just, it angers me, Joe. It really does.
And what about
it angers me so much.
And what about the basics, Edward? Like, can you go on a holiday?
Not at all. We haven't been on holidays. I'm a very emotional man. I'm a very soft man. I'm a good man. I'm a real good man, but this stuff gets me so bad, it does. You know, I have to go, Joe, because I'll start crying, to be honest with you. Okay. I'm sorry to say that.
Thanks
for having me on your show.
I think people get a glimpse, Edward, of the real pain that people are going through because of the actions of this bank.
Veronica was also livid.
To listen to those two guys mocking and laughing and making such a joke of what they were going to do and how they were going to fool the government into this.
A statement from Mr. Bowe said, this is to Paul Williams in the Irish Window, it was gallows humour.
Is that what he calls it? And is it still gallows humour that every person in the country is still carrying the burden, except for, of course, those two buckos and the likes of them? I just feel at this stage now that something really, really needs to give and something major needs to be done. And people need to be brought to book because everybody that's going into work every single day, like you and I and every other working person that has any integrity or dignity about them, are doing their best for whatever job they happen to be doing. They're creased. The most people are with this universal social charge to bail out the banks, who are the whole instigators in all of this. The people that are going out to work every day, 9 to 5 or whatever hours they're doing, they're not the people that brought this country to their knees. We're the people that's picking up the tab and keeping it going now.
And Barry, too, had a horror story to tell.
Almost unbearable at this stage. And we have, you know, shock and horror at these tapes when there has been evidence that the figures that were given to Brian Lenehan were unclear to begin with. My business collapsed, Joe. My banks withdrew funding. My business collapsed. But I was a fool. I paid back over 4 million quid at the detriment of my family. You know, I lost my home, my pension, my investments. You know, I was of the generation that, you know, you work hard, you keep your head down and be honourable and you'll always do okay, you know.
So you made my mistake, Joe. You honoured your commitment.
Yeah, I honoured my commitment, and I still owe 500,000, but I'm not able to eat, never mind.
But you hear these guys laughing when they say the 7 billion, will we repay it? Will we? They laugh.
Yeah, and in the box they say no repayment.
Just some of the nightmare stories heard on Liveline with Joe Duffy. With the Taoiseach and Tánaiste expressing their disgust at the Anglo phone revelations, it would appear that an Oireachtas inquiry is now on the cards.
Get out of my seat, Jimmy. That's my seat. Come on,
okay, order in the house. Order. Allow the Taoiseach without interruption. Please, shut up now.
Sean Corla, without further delay, I wish to propose the setting up of an independent, non-partisan Oireachtas committee inquiry which will objectively and efficiently find Fianna Fáil wholly responsible for the banking crisis. The recession, and the sequence of events which catastrophically led to myself, Phil Hogan, James Riley, and others reaching government through no fault of our own.
You left out Shatter and Richard Bruton.
Then, Kyungkola, we can allow the criminal justice system to fully prosecute those responsible for our economic collapse, who we hope will get a maximum penalty of a €5,000 fine and a half hour of community service mowing the lawns at the K-Club.
That is far too lenient. You should give them 2 hours and make them water the flowers as well.
And I will not interfere. I will not interfere in any way with the inquiry, except to say that John McGuinness may not be on it and that his wife should not be following him.
Without interruption, shut up!
Kyungkola, I believe we should appoint a respected independent judge from overseas to head up a tribunal of inquiry. A judge who's used to settling disputes. Who's used to settling disputes over money. Judge Judy.
Put that fag out, Deputy Ming. Put Minister Howland down, Deputy Ferris.
Can we go on holidays now, Kyungkola?
No bloody manner!
Laughing and crying, you know, it's the same relief. Oliver Callan heard on Callan's Kicks last night. And the governor of the central bank, Patrick Honahan, had this to say to reporter Petula Martin after he attended a performance of Colin Murphy's play Guaranteed, which is all about the bailout.
I found myself, even though I know the story so well, I found myself tense throughout and going through that time again, although I wasn't a participant. But I noticed a lot of people seemed angry.
There are calls for a banking inquiry. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think this is going to come. I'm actually looking forward to it.
But Richard Curran of the Sunday Business Post questioned the value of an Oireachtas inquiry.
I think that the pitfalls of Oireachtas inquiries, notwithstanding the Abbey Lara judgment, and there are questions as to whether or not individual bankers and various other people will go to court and question how they're going to be treated by this inquiry, there is the problem that this could descend into a party political semi-farce. I mean, in one sense, you know, Fianna Fáil and their role in creating the financial monster boom and bust is well known and should be on the curriculum in schools. But equally, Joan Burton's suggestion that perhaps all of these Fianna Fáilers should come out and engage in a truth commission without the commission doesn't necessarily seems to me to tee things up for a party political slagging match, and that's not going to serve any good at this stage.
There is, I suppose, one possibility that remains, whatever about a commission and the limitations on it, some of them, of course, imposed by the electorate when they rejected an opportunity to strengthen parliamentary inquiries, which, of course, don't cost anything, but they got the opportunity and they said no. But at least there is the prospect of putting people into the stocks, whether they're former ministers or former bank executives, and giving them a hard time. In other words, basically, how dare you? How could you possibly have done this? What possible reasons did you think of the effects and so on? That would be satisfying, wouldn't it, at least?
I think it might make a lot of angry members of the public feel good. The question is whether it would provide answers that would be useful. And one of the difficulties with Oireachtas inquiries or Oireachtas hearings in general is often the news reports and the newspaper headlines are made up of the question that is asked rather than the answer. Now, I know that for a very serious investigation like this, it would be conducted on a more serious level and they would be trying to get answers. But I would feel at this stage that so many things have been gotten wrong in the process. This is really the last shot. This is the last crack. And we are better off to have this than not to have it at all. People deserve answers. There has not been a single forum, whether it be a civil court, a criminal court, a public inquiry, where people could read or see the version of events that a senior banker in any of the banks has about what happened. They have been deprived and denied that while taking a huge amount of austerity partially linked to that. Yes, the inquiry, if it goes ahead, and it should go ahead, will achieve that, but it isn't going to be what it should or could have been in finding answers and bringing true accountability.
Richard Curran and Richard will be with you shortly, just after the 10 o'clock news with the business. On the gathering yesterday, Miles Dungan was joined by journalist Noreen Hegarty, Dan O'Brien of the Irish Times, and the Irish Independent's legal editor, Dervil MacDonald.
Look, it's a fantastic scoop from a journalist point of view, from a public interest point of view. It's a really important story. And no more than anybody else, very shocked. You know, you're listening to the very smug, flippant, arrogant, masters of the universe type language. How could you be anything but shocked by the content of the tapes? That said, I think there's been a lot of a disingenuous approach by politicians to this. You know, you see Michael Noonan coming out and saying that he kind of suspected when Brian Lenihan was coming into the Dáil and saying Anglo needed 7 billion that it'd be a bit more. And then you have the Taoiseach expressing his shock and his surprise and the Taoiseach. Now, they've been in government for the guts of 2.5 years. They've had numerous opportunities. If there was a political will, number one, have a banking inquiry of some kind. They surely should have gone through the books for due diligence when they got into government. I know we had the referendum and there is an argument that they carelessly lost it. But here we are, more than a year after the referendum, nearly 18 months in fact, and now we're talking about legislation being enacted in the Dáil. So nothing is going to happen in the lifetime of this government, I suspect.
Dan, were you surprised?
No. Could you just sort of say that bankers should be afraid of their regulator, and regulators should be ready to bully bankers when that's necessary, not the other way around. And the tapes prove, as if that needed proving, that in this country, bankers bully the regulator. I think it's also worth saying that that has not changed enough.
Derval, react to the reaction to your own story, and in particular the political reaction.
Joe, I was chatting to someone last night about the Anglo tapes, and they were saying that it reminded them of the folklore, you know, back from the days of the famine, where what enraged and devastated those who were emigrating and those who didn't get a chance to was when you were going past the big house where there was a party on and you could hear the laughter. And I think that there's something about that this week, when we could hear the laughter. It's kind of the callous smugness. It was the frat boy stuff. We weren't surprised, I don't think, by the actual content, although when you strip away that language, the substance is nonetheless shocking. The story has moved on in some respects because it is about the political reaction, the global reaction to it. Angela Merkel was, perhaps being German, she was characteristically restrained, but she was careful not to just point the finger solely at Ireland and said that this carry-on, the conduct of the bankers, was evident in Germany and elsewhere. And I think the important point that she made from a European policy perspective, and this is very, very true in an Irish context, is that it is very, very hard to go out to the normal people and sell austerity and tell them they're going to have to face more years of hardship when you hear this.
Derval MacDonald, Dan O'Brien and Noreen Hegarty heard on the Today Show yesterday. While all the talk was about the Anglo billions this week, in Riley's Super Value store in Salins in County Kildare, the rumours were flying that the latest Euro Lotto millionaire was from the town and that the €94 million Euro jackpot ticket had been sold by that shop. Fergus Riley, the owner, spoke with Cathal McCullough.
There was every way to collect a generator for barbecue on Saturday with a summer barbecue for our customers, and their phone has just happened since about the win, and I suppose what we say is it could be anyone. We heard Larry Corbett was supposed to win the Euro Millions a few weeks ago, and please God it is someone in Salins. Like, the rumour is still going that it's someone in the catchment, but we don't know, and all we do is wish whoever has won us lots of happiness from their big win.
But it's not you.
It's not me anyway, no. I'm here trying to lift a generator into Buttermy car for our barbecue on Saturday for our customers with a summer barbecue, and it's definitely not me anyway. But I did ring the shop this morning to see where everyone at work, because we do a syndicate of work, and they're all there, so I don't think it's any of us that's the winner anyway.
Yes, it was a false trail anyway, and the real winner has opted for anonymity. The Irish Open is taking place in Carton House in County Kildare. The big draw for the week was world number 2 Rory McIlroy, as he made a rare return home to compete. As ever, he was struggling with national identity when he spoke with Greg Allen.
I'm here at Carton House with Rory McIlroy. Rory, it must be nice to be back playing in front of a home crowd.
Well, Carton is not my home, Greg. My home is in Florida with my girlfriend Caroline.
Yes, of course, but the Irish Open...
Wait, you mean the Ireland Open, Greg? I think you mean...
All of the home fans here must make it special for you, Rory.
Well, hold up a wee minute, buddy. I think you mean familiar fans, Greg, from all of the islands of the North Atlantic archipelago. Period.
Yes, well, it is a tournament all Irish golfers look forward to.
Well, I'm sure they do, Greg. So do British golfers, of course, and Isle of Man golfers.
Well, then, are you looking forward to the British Open?
I think what you mean there is the other island open, buddy.
Okay, well, speaking of the other island, I see Caroline has crashed out of Wimbledon.
Yeah, I was trying to follow it on something called TG4, but I can't make out a word of it. It's in some foreign language.
That's actually Irish, Rory.
Oh, right. Wow. That's why I didn't understand. Stand it then, because it's not in my native tongue.
And is English your native tongue, the language of your home?
Oh, Neil Sogham.
Thanks, Ormac.
To Fulcher Road, Greg. So long.
Oliver Callan, who's everywhere, from Callan's Kicks last night. Last weekend marked 6 months since the tragic death of Junior Minister Shane McEntee. Shane took his own life just before Christmas, and you may remember at his funeral, his brother Gerry criticised those who'd abused his brother through social media. Gerry McEntee spoke exclusively to Damien O'Reilly on Countrywide.
Do you remember the last time you spoke to him, Gerry?
I do, yeah. I rang him on the Wednesday. He died on the Friday, and it was his birthday on the Wednesday. And I rang him and he didn't answer his mobile, which was strange on his birthday because he'd have known why I was ringing him. And I rang the home number and Kathleen answered the phone and he came to the phone and he was quiet. That's all I would say, because it's funny, when I hung up, Yvonne says to me, "How was he?" And I said, "He's quiet." And we both commented that it was strange that they hadn't gone out, because they were social animals, the two of them, compared to us, I suppose. But Kathleen said we were having a quiet evening at home.
And Gerry, when you got the phone call to say that Shane had died, I presume obviously you just couldn't believe it. Can you remember that moment, or when did you get the call?
Oh, I can remember it on the Friday morning, yeah. Dr. Martin White rang and he asked me where I was, and I told him, and I knew there was something wrong. He asked me, was I on my own? And well, I'd never have expected that if, when I heard of the way that he died, I'd never have expected Shane.
You spoke very, very strongly in the church, Gerry, out against people who had been critical to Shane on social message boards, on the radio, and indeed in personal text messages. I mean, what was that the case, and did that annoy him?
Well, that was the case. I mean, politicians know that debate and criticism goes with part of the territory. And I don't mind him going on a debate on the local radio with people who criticise him, and he has the opportunity to reply. But I do have a major problem with people downright abusing him on the social networks and no names attached. They can say whatever they like, because there's no face and no name. No one merits faceless abuse from cowards who don't even put their name to it.
Gerry McEntee, brother of the late Shane McEntee, who spoke with Damien O'Reilly on last week's Countrywide, produced by Sinead Egan. The Jesuit priest, Peter McVerry, was invited to Oras an Uachtaráin by President Higgins to mark his work with the homeless over the past 30 years.
Were drugs a big problem when you started, or did that hit later on?
No, we never heard of drugs when we started. The big problem when we started was the local off-licence selling cider to the kids. We were organising protests and getting the guards involved. Now we'd love to be back there. Drugs only came in the 80s, serious drugs, heroin, only came in the 1980s, and then it disappeared for a while. It was controlled by one group, one family, and once they were arrested and taken off the street, drugs disappeared. But it came back in the early 90s, came back with a vengeance, changed the whole nature of working with homeless people, but made it far more difficult and obliged us to expand our services into providing drug treatment. It meant that getting accommodation was more difficult. Neighbours didn't want drug users living anywhere near them, and I can understand that. But also it meant that even if you could help a young person who was homeless into accommodation, the possibility of them losing that accommodation again was very, very high because of the inadequacy of the addiction services that were available to them.
How many young people can you accommodate today on a daily basis?
The moment we'd have about 275 homeless people staying with us at night time, and we'd have 400 or 500 also coming through our drop-in centre every month. It's still only a drop in the ocean. It's still only less than 10% of the homeless people in the Dublin area.
And do you ever have spare capacity, or do you have to turn people away?
We're turning people away all the time. And that's been a change in the last few years. All our hostels are full, permanently full, and they all have waiting lists. And it's very, very sad. A young person comes looking for accommodation. They may be in a desperate state, and you have to say, look, I'm sorry, we don't have anything. Try Dublin City Council free phone number. You just might get emergency, awful emergency accommodation from them.
Is it very difficult to turn people away?
It's very difficult. Especially young people come and they're maybe only just recently homeless, never touched a drug in their life. And when we say, I'm sorry, we don't have accommodation, we know they are going to be accommodated in an emergency accommodation full of drugs with some very difficult people there. It's a frightening place. It's an intimidating place. I often, honestly, do advise some people to sleep rough rather than go into the emergency accommodation. So bad.
Father Peter McVerry with Miles Dungan. The writer Michael Harding used to be a Roman Catholic priest before he took to writing full-time. He and his wife, the sculptor Cathy Carman, were Miriam O'Callaghan's guests on the last of the current edition of Miriam Meets.
And I find sometimes when you're working, you're hammering away and banging, and you're, what are you at? Why is your obsession doing this kind of thing? You're wrecking your body and your ears and drums and everything. And I find if I go anywhere, I even found myself, we were away there last week in Portugal, and there I am in the hardware shop looking for something interesting to hammer with, you know. And they're looking at me, what's this tourist doing in here?
Looking for a hammer.
I just say that it's another part of where I find Cathy. So intrinsically, the artist and the person is the one thing that, yeah. You know, she's the man about the house. Do you know what I mean? If builders come to build a shed, it's her to talk to, not me. And they're there, she's talking technical stuff to them about plaster and walls or something, because she has a beautiful compulsion of a tradesperson or a craftsperson or an artist. She has an obsession not just with the kind of finished work, but the process. So she's endlessly in hardware shops. She wears me out. I get totally crazy. You're on holidays and she ends up in a hardware shop looking at chisels or something.
And then Lidl's came to Ireland, you know, and I had Lidlitis for at least 2 years, you know.
She was in bed last night. We were in bed last night.
Yeah.
And like, there's that moment where you know it's about gone asleep. The last sort of good night, I'll see you in the morning. And I know she's still awake and she says, what was it? There's a hedge cutter in Lidl's this week on Thursday. I said, great. That's something to dream about.
Cathy Carman and her husband, Michael Harding, heard on Miriam Meets, produced by Eileen Herron.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
It was all about love on The Mooney Show when Brenda Donoghue met up with couples who were attaching love locks to the Ha'penny Bridge in Dublin. And if you've ever been to Paris or Prague, it's a huge tradition there too.
They're actually writing on the bridge. Let me go over. Excuse me. Hello. You've got a permanent marker out. What's your plan?
Well, we're coming away from England to do this because we don't have this in England.
We got married a couple of days ago. So
oh, congratulations, first of all.
So we brought the lock to because we'd heard about it in France on the Seine.
So where is your lock? You've just that put it up? Yeah. It's that one there. So you have your marker to write on it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Before you do, can I just say something? Dublin City Council are saying they're damaging the bridge.
Yes, yes.
Well, they're causing rust and it's a protected bridge. Correct. Would that stop you in any way?
Graffiti is art. It's not art expressionism of the people. So if people don't have freedom to express themselves, what do they have?
For both of you here, newlyweds,
yeah.
How symbolic is it what you're doing right now?
We're going to come back in 5 years' time. We got married in England, but we're going to come back in 5 years' time, renew our vows, and hopefully that will be back here when we come back here.
It's just a symbolic of our love entwined and they're immortalised.
Well, Peter and Karen, you're obviously going ahead.
Yes.
Even though I told you about Dublin City Council, can I witness as you work away, okay?
Yeah. Okay. It's just want to say, like a thing, it's a symbolism of love. Once it's there, it's locked on, it's there forever, and so's love. And just want to show how much I love her.
And we threw the keys away so it can never be unlocked. Yeah. It's there like a circle forevermore. I love you always, forever.
I love you too.
Aw, bless.
Aw, Brenda Donoghue heard on The Mooney Show. It was all about love or finding the meaning of life when Gay Byrne went in search of the meaning of Bono. He talked brass tacks with the U2 frontman last night.
Hello, friends. I'm here to ask all the big questions. What's it all about? Why am I here? Do you know a good accountant? This week, I talk to young Bono in my new series, The Meaning of Cash. Hello, Bono.
Peace out, man. Peace.
Bono, if I don't ask you this, I'll be criticised. And if I do ask you this, I'll be criticised. And hither and thither and betwixt and between and so on and so forth. But on the subject of U2's taxation,
yes.
Why did you move your business to the Netherlands?
Well, the surprising thing here is U2 behaving like a business.
Yes, like Apple.
Well, I brought Apple here and Google and Facebook and Tato and the Bug of Allen.
Yes.
But the thing is, there are some very clever people in government and the revenue.
Not clever enough, it seems.
Who've attracted business here.
Not yours, it seems, Sonny.
But in the end, Gay, we're tax sensible.
Yes, you two don't pay it here.
Well, would you keep your money here?
I have little money, Bonnie, oh, my friend.
Oh, yeah.
Ripped off I was. Twice, I'll have you know.
I am amazed at the intelligence of the Irish people figuring a way out, because they could be on the streets and torching.
And what way out is that, pray tell?
They're smarter than that, realising you have to track jobs and get through this.
What are you actually talking about, Bonavox?
And
my dear old friend, have you gone completely mad?
And they're not turning on the heating and feeding their children, and they're clever enough to go without food, and the really smart ones are emigrating and working three jobs to pay the mortgage. It's heroic.
Okay, well done, Sonny, well done. We have to leave it there.
Cool.
Next week on this series, I speak to the young god in my new show, The Meaning of Bono.
Great.
Until next week, friends. Can I hit your lift back with you Southside, Sonny?
Oh, you're mad. I'm not staying in this kip. I'm off to Nice.
Get the jet ready. I'm out of here.
Dear, oh dear, dear, oh dear. Insufferable bullocks.
Bono and Gay, a.k.a. Oliver Callan, from Callan's Kicks last night. Well, we all love the notion of summer, even if we don't get the weather.
So you just get the lime there and
okay,
we'll
Paul, right. I have the pegs up now at the far side.
Hold on a minute, stop that car coming in. Just look at that lad coming in there.
Here's Willie coming in with the trailer, lads.
Just make sure that plot number 27 is marked properly. That line's a bit crooked.
Countrywide reporter Martina McGlynn went turf cutting on Clonard Bog outside Dangan in County Offaly.
Now, Willie, how are you getting on?
I'm getting on well, and the sod is fairly uniform and it doesn't look to be too bad, and I think I have a good piece of bank. I'm looking at Ollie over there where he's cutting, and don't know whether he's going to bait me or not, but sure, we leave it up to the judge here.
So Oliver, just take me through exactly what you're doing there.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to start to cut now, Martina. Some people, it depends on the turf, some people put their foot on the sand like that, some people cut it. What I'm doing with the strength of their arms, that's what they call footing the sleighing there. Now you can see there. I'm throwing it over to my helper here, and he's putting it on the bar, and of course it's wheeled out onto the bank then. You see, and then after that the labour starts, you have to dry it all.
I'm John Harrigan, I'm over here from Milltown, Newbridge County Kildare. I'm over here in Offaly, and I'm delighted to be here and looking at two good and great men cutting turf, I think.
Come on, Ollie.
I think one of them is out to get a brown envelope now, and I won't agree to that now, because the brown envelopes are gone now this few years. That's Willie. Willie is good. He's cutting a nice sod, but not one gets a little bit bigger than the other now. That's, you want to be cutting them dead on every side.
Oh, well,
but the other man now, he's cutting a good square sod, 10 inches by 4 inches, and that'll win any competition.
Come on, lads. Come on.
A Day on the Bog, Martina McGlynn, reporting for Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly. So you think it's been a rocky week here, but spare a thought for Julia Gillard, who was the first woman Prime Minister of Australia until she was ousted by former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd this week, a man she'd stabbed in the back 3 years ago. During her tenure as Prime Minister, she had to face down a lot of sexist jibes and misogyny, but she didn't take it lying down. Miriam O'Callaghan recalled one of Julia's fieriest speeches.
We have a clip here of Julia. I mean, it went viral a while back. It's the first time really I thought she was incredible. She gave this blistering speech against sexism and misogyny in the Australian House of Representatives. She was responding, of course, to Tony Abbott. Let's just have a listen to her now in full flow.
And the government will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. Not now, not ever. The Leader of the Opposition says that people who hold sexist views and who are misogynists are not appropriate for high office. Well, I hope the Leader of the Opposition has got a piece of paper and he is writing out his resignation. Because if he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives. He needs a mirror. That's what he needs.
From the John Murray Show with Miriam O'Callaghan. Well, I leave you now with tunes from Donal Lunny and John Carthy, who played live on the Today Show on Thursday and who'll be giving masterclasses in traditional music at the Blas Festival in the University of Limerick. Gurum haagwaith asfar golúidir, tá súlam gur bhain sibh sult as a glór, agus gmeisibh lom, tá an amach ina an tachtan seo thugann. Go dtí sin, go dtí sibh slán.